evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. A new report says the media is under siege in South Sudan.
Journalists and media workers account for a quarter of these victims. These incidents include the killing of two people, arbitrary arrest and detention of 58 others, 16 people who have been dismissed from their jobs.
And the Anglican Church joins the Vatican in praying for peace in South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new report says the South Sudan government continues to censor the media and restrict freedom of expression. The report entitled Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression in South Sudan Since the July 2016 Crisis warns that the restriction on freedom of expression are having, quote, chilling effect and it shrinks the space for debate in South Sudan. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Over the past 18 months, researchers with the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, and the UN Human Rights Office interviewed victims, witnesses, activists, and journalists across South Sudan and documented 99 allegations of rights abuses. The 35-page report says researchers verified 60 incidents in which the right to freedom of expression of 102 victims were violated. According to the cessation of hostilities agreement signed by the government and various South Sudanese stakeholders in December, harassing of media personnel is a violation of the deal. UNMISS Chief David Sierra told the reporters in Juba today that most of the incidents occurred in government-controlled areas and many of the victims are media personnel.
Journalists and media workers account for a quarter of these victims. These incidents include the killing of two people, arbitrary arrest and detention of 58 others, 16 people who have been dismissed from their jobs, the closure or suspension of media houses, censorship of newspaper articles, and the blocking of websites. Those targeted were deemed to be critical of the government and accused of tarnishing the country's reputation.
The report says the National Security Service, or NSS, the police, the army, and government officials at national and state levels, along with the South Sudan Media Authority, are responsible for violating people's rights. The reports singled out the National Security as the main perpetrator, responsible for 33% of the violations, followed by the South Sudan Army, SPLA. Repeated calls to Minister of Information and Government spokesperson Michael Makwe for comment on the report were not successful as all of his phone numbers were not going through. South Sudan military spokesman Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwang told South Sudan in Focus he has not seen the UN report and could not comment in detail. He says he is not aware of any government soldiers muzzling the media.
Since I assumed office about 2 years ago, it has not been reported to us anywhere that the SPLA had harassed or arrested any foreign journalist. The primary responsibility lies with South Sudan Media Authority. That's the body that allows foreign journalists to come into the country.
Elijah Alier, head of the Media Authority, says he cannot comment on the report because he has not seen it. Eugene Nindorera is the head of the Human Rights Division at UNMISS. He says most of the verified incidents occurred in government-controlled areas. He says researchers could not travel to rebel-controlled areas to investigate reported abuses due to insecurity. Nindorera says South Sudan's national security arrest, detain, and embed its officers in some newspapers printing establishments, forcing South Sudanese journalists operating in Juba into self-censorship. But Nindorera says the government sought a gesture of goodwill in recent months.
A number of positive initiatives were undertaken by the government, civil society, and other stakeholders. This includes the release of several political activists and journalists who had been arbitrarily held in government custody, the provision of educational opportunities to strengthen national capacities for responsible journalism, training of state authorities on permissible restriction to the exercise of freedom of expression, and efforts made to address certain incidents of hate speech. However, the report highlights that gaps remain.
Atem Simon is an editor at the Juba-based Ali Mogif newspaper. He says his news organization struggles to report stories in a professional way.
We have faced many challenges, especially under the government directives that we should not balance our stories. We have to report from one side, report in a very crucial issues that needed the story to be professional.
Dennis Elamo is a Juba-based journalist who says he welcomes the report, adding that it highlights the biggest challenge facing the media industry across South Sudan.
There must be some kind of solution to end this conflict, because this all as a result of the ongoing conflict.
The report says genuine reconciliation and lasting peace can only be achieved in South Sudan if people are free and safe to express their opinions regardless of ethnic or political affiliations. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on politics in South Sudan, South Sudanese lawmakers have summoned the national ministers of finance, trade, and commerce and investment, and the interior, as well as the central bank governor, to explain why prices of commodities have skyrocketed in the country. Some residents say restoring genuine peace is the only way to end the country's economic crisis. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Juba.
Linda Simon is a resident of Juba town. She says she's frustrated by the ever-increasing prices of food, water, and other essentials.
You can get here water is for 50. In the other places, you can get it for 80. So it's raising and differs from shop to shop. Even this small thing like the washing shop, you see the small piece like this, in other shops is for 40.
Juba residents say food prices rise every day. 2 weeks ago, a kilogram of beef was sold at 700 South Sudanese pounds. Today, a kilogram of beef is sold at 1,200 South Sudanese pounds. Lawmaker Bidali Moses, who represents Yei County in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, introduced the motion to summon the ministers to parliament to explain the market prices. He says the central government has done nothing to address the high cost of living.
The escalation in the prices has been ongoing, unchecked by responsible ministries and institutions of finance, economic planning, trade, commerce, and investment, as well as the Bank of South Sudan. No effort has been taken to curtail these skyrocketing prices in the extent that the common citizen find it difficult to subsist, and civil servants are at the loss as to what to do with the salaries which suffer from acute devaluation and delay in payment frequency.
Moses called on his fellow lawmakers to come up with measures that will help normalize prices of basic goods, services, and restore hope among the South Sudanese citizens. Joyce Dusman represents Lanya County in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly. She agrees it is time to act.
The Ministry of Commerce and Trade, what is this ministry doing? Because if the prices is just shooting and the currencies is going up, the government, we are keeping quiet about what is going. Are we really representing people in this country? Are we seeing the suffering of the people? Do we know in some families how many days people even could not get food to eat?
Dusman says last year, the Transitional National Assembly tried to reduce charges and custom duties on basic goods and commodities entering the country as a way to keep commodity prices stable. But those efforts had little impact on soaring prices across the country. Joy Kwaje Olzai represents Juba West in the National Assembly. Kwaje says the effects of skyrocketing prices have contributed to a new report released by UNICEF ranking South Sudan among the top 10 countries in Africa with the highest newborn mortality rate.
What is written here has a direct connection with even the mortality rate of everybody, including and more so of our mothers who are delivering in the hospital. The mortality rate has risen because these mothers cannot even feed well. They cannot have money to get access to antenatal care because of the cost. People prefer to have either a meal a day or a meal in 2 days. Ya jamaa, this is about the people who have voted for the independence of this country. It is important that we look at how we can control or how we can ease their situation.
Linda Simon welcomes the move by lawmakers to question the executive branch of the government, but doubts if it will solve the problem.
Though these people, if they were summoned, it will not help us. The only thing is to improve the insecurity of the country or to bring peace, the real peace that we wanted to our country, so that all these things maybe will be settled down.
She says as long as South Sudan continues to import food from neighboring countries, its citizens will continue to suffer. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
Still in Juba, the Anglican Communion is joining the Vatican tomorrow in a day of prayers and fasting for peace in South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Archbishop Josiah Edu Faison is the Secretary General of the Anglican Consultative Council. He says the Anglican Communion will join the Catholics to remember the people affected by conflict in the two countries. Archbishop Josiah is appealing to the leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan to end violence and restore peace in their countries.
Why these two countries? Number one, you will see that the extent of the loss of lives, the extent of the suffering in these two countries, honestly, is an embarrassment to Africans in particular and the powers that be in the world in general. For example, look at the South Sudan. Majority profess one religion. And DRC is the same. So it's not a question of inter-religious. It has to do with an endemic problem on the continent of Africa: tribalism, corruption, power. And I think this is one of the reasons why my own Archbishop of Canterbury and other religious leaders, denominations, are supporting this call for to have an ecumenical approach.
Archbishop, bring us up to speed on what will happen tomorrow in the Anglican Communion.
When we participate in ecumenical calls like this particular one, what we expect our bishops to do in the various provinces is to get their clergy, inform them with updates on the situation in South Sudan, where millions of people have been displaced, DRC the same. So the priests will now inform their members. They will not only pray, those of them who can actually support these people who've been displaced, who are now in other countries, I expect them to even say, well, in support, this is a practical support for our sisters and brothers who are unfortunately caught in this power play, I would say. I expect them to concentrate tomorrow praying and to have a follow-up.
And I'm sure the Anglican Communion gets updates on the situation in South Sudan, especially the Episcopal Church of South Sudan. What kind of reports do you get from the Anglican Church in South Sudan about the situation?
Well, the reports we get are mainly from the camps. You know, our Archbishop has been there twice, and he did not even stop in South Sudan. He went to the camps in Uganda. The wife of the Archbishop of Canterbury, she was also there, I think about 3 months ago, 2.5 months ago. Went with some of the women here and actually spoke to them, stayed with them, prayed with them to show our solidarity. So it's not a question of sitting there in Canterbury. Both the Archbishop and his wife have been actively engaged with the people in the camps.
if you're given an opportunity to speak to the leaders of these two countries, DRC and South Sudan, what would your message be to them?
Well, as a Christian leader, I would honestly appeal to them to sink their political differences, come together and agree, particularly South Sudan, which is the youngest country in the world. Everybody had high hopes for this country. I will appeal to them, just as my Archbishop has been doing, the Pope himself has been doing, and some of the other church leaders. Please come together. Agree on how to share power. Get this country moving. You are there for a short period. Other people will definitely take over from you. What have you got to hand over to those who will be taking over from you? I will do that. But for the DRC, I will appeal to the sitting president. When a leader knows that his popularity is sinking, the popularity is disappearing, for the sake of the people, his own people, our own people, I will expect that leader to either change his style or to say, well, if this is the case, let's have an election, let somebody else take over. But unfortunately, we have not come to that level yet on the continent of Africa, and it's sad.
That's Archbishop Jose Edu Feon, the Secretary General of the Anglican Consultative Council. He was speaking to me from Cairo, Egypt, earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the SPLM former detainees continue to express their frustration with how the country is moving. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how would you define a perfect day?
I would define a perfect day in a way that if I wake up in the morning, I'm free from disease, I'm not feeling any pain, I get my breakfast in time, I go for work, I don't get any mess on the road. You know, taxis, those conductors know how to mess up our days.
Yeah, my perfect day is that I think when I get money, I mean, let's assume I do a business and then I get my money at once when the business has been done, my profit has come.
Yeah, perfect day is a day that I've not had bad news. It's the day that I've achieved all my goals. It's a day of celebration for me.
When you are with friends and you can spend your day smiling and then be happy. Then when you're happy, which means it's a good day for you.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The former SPLM detainees are blaming the Kiir administration for lack of peace in South Sudan. South Sudan's former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot says the situation in South Sudan requires what he calls urgent intervention.
To form a hybrid administration with technocrats, and they have to be vetted through a rigorous process that will look at their moral standing in the society, things having to do with corruption, whether they have the right skills to bring to be part of the interim administration. It's not just a matter of picking any politician and appointing these politicians to be part of this administration. So we said, okay, let us get the best of the two, the technocrats and the politicians with the skills to run this administration. However, they will have no stakes. They will have no stakes whatsoever in the administration of South Sudan for the next 10 years.
This is well said, Dr. Majak. It sounds beautiful, but the devil is in the details. This is a situation where you are dealing with people, you normally call them the gun class. How would you really bring such proposal where you have people who are believing in military solution to everything?
Well, in the context of Africa, this has been tried before. And if you're talking of gun class, there was no state that was much of a gun class than apartheid South Africa And especially during the last days under de Klerk, how did that war end? It ended through negotiations. The apartheid was negotiated out because the future of the country did not rest in running a system that was decayed, a system that had no future for its people. The same situation happened in the early 1980s with Ian Smith, Southern Rhodesia. What happened? They were negotiated out of power. And they were told that it is in the interest of the people of Zimbabwe, the then Southern Rhodesia, that there ought to be a new transition that would only succeed if they step aside. It is the same thing in Liberia with Charles Taylor. So people come around, people who are not well read in history, and they tell us that this is too idealistic, and what you're now trying to propose has not been tried everywhere. And we tell them, no. In the case of Africa, there are these three successful examples. Tell us, why did the people take that route? People took that route because they wanted to save their country. They wanted to get their people back together, because we are now at a very difficult crossroad as people of South Sudan, and we have to do something radical that will really help the country come out of this quagmire.
And talking about something very radical, when the government delegation, the opposition, came back from Addis, I tried to follow the narratives from these two groups. The government says the opposition made it very impossible, I'm using their words, made it very impossible for peace to return to South Sudan. The opposition says the government has no political will to bring peace to South Sudan. Now, when I listen to the two groups, my conclusion is it's just about blame games here.
Well, unfortunately, politics is all that about, John. Politics is about blame game, but I don't want to get into that. Look at what the opposition is saying, that the political will is lacking. They are right in that. That the government is intransigent. They are right in that. Going for a radical option like we are doing is not about being intransigent. We are sitting around the table. We have made our critique of the status quo. We have said our country will be trapped in endless transitions. From 2005, it was a transition. Even affirming Salva Kiir or confirming Salva Kiir as the president of South Sudan after the referendum and after the proclamation of independence was a transition. 2015, at Addis, it was a transition. We are now going for another transition. In our view, we call it a cycle of transition. We're trying to be happy in endorsing something that should be temporary to be permanent. And we say we don't want to be there permanently. We have to get out. Let the people have their choice and elect their leaders.
That's Majak Dagot, South Sudan's former Deputy Defense Minister. He was speaking to me from our studio in Nairobi earlier yesterday. The founder of a non-profit calling itself Humanity Helping Sudan began the 734 Coffee Initiative in an effort to economically empower South Sudanese back home. The 734 represents the geographical coordinate for the Gambela region in Ethiopia, where over 2,000 South Sudanese are living as refugees, including Kiir. During the Second Civil War, he says the concept of 734 Coffee is simple. Coffee is a natural unifier, helping people all over the world to come together to talk over a cup of coffee. While 734 Coffee wants people to start talking, it also goes an extra step in advocating for refugees.
And the reason I use coffee is because South Sudan has now begun to grow coffee. And the best way to help that young country grow an economy, it would be to start a coffee project. Now, I'm not saying that all the coffee that we get come from Sudan, but it is our goal that in the future that we're going to be bringing all the coffee from southern Sudan. And that will also create a job for the people in the southern Sudan. But then that coffee will also create a dialogue within the tribe in southern Sudan, because I think the problem was in the tribe in southern Sudan, they hadn't get to sit together. If they sit together and have a coffee, they'll be able to help or understand one another. That's the reason for the coffee.
And you've been selling your coffee here in the States for a while now. What's the reception been?
Well, I mean, everyone drink coffee in the morning. You can go everywhere. I mean, you can run to 20 people today. I guarantee you, you will find at least 10 of them drink coffee this morning. The idea that, you know, they can do good things while they're drinking coffee they really love, I mean, is something that, you know, is going to be accepted to everybody. You know, I believe that every table in America, either you drink coffee or don't drink coffee, you should have a bag of 734 on your table so you will learn about the refugee issue.
South Sudan's coffee-growing region has not been spared from the conflict. We've seen big brand names pull out of the country because of conflict, because the Equatorial regions have been affected by the conflict. And I'm wondering, how has the conflict affected your ability to sell your coffee?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. All this big business, they can say they pull it out of because of war and all that. But do you really look at the underlying problem? Is that, you know, the training wasn't enough. You know, the resources that were put there wasn't that enough. Like, you can look it another way. You can look at the coffee problem itself. You can also look at the, you know, at the country itself. You know, Southern Sudan has not been a country that promotes coffee from the very beginning. They don't know the coffee. So it's harder for them to train. But then the other problem is that, you know, when the people were trained, they were trained with one machine. So it is really harder for them to be able to use a market within the local region, because the machine they were trained for is just used for that one company to collect the coffee.
Manyang, you are a lawyer by training. Tell me, how does a young man like you go from studying the law to growing coffee?
Right now, we're paying people to go to school in Kenya, like a university student. If you go to our website, you will find them. We're sending them to school, and I feel proud of it. Just being an advocate, I can't do that because it's going to take money to do that. And now I don't need to ask anybody else. The 734 can fund it. And that's the only option I can be able to help people in southern Sudan. And that's the only option I could be able to do what I really, really love, that to helping people.
That was Manyang Red Kerr speaking to Ayin Biordeng from Washington, where he now lives. Kerr claims that every purchase of 734 coffee, a percentage of the proceeds will go to help sponsor refugee education and training. That's our show for this Thursday, and we now leave you with the song Tengema by Fabregas.
Mama l'ambiance l'enjaillement ne finit pas. DJ Poulio, ça c'est la nouvelle danse congolaise. La danse d'un côté, Mama Tengamaï.
Well, we've been listening to a test of that song, Tengema by Fabregas. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Would like to know what you think about this show. You can reach us at southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Thanks for inviting us into your homes and vehicles. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.